the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. One of the big questions a lot of Christians are considering as we look towards the 2008 political season, and as much as, frankly, we might not want to quite yet look to that political season, it is now here among us. You already have the Democratic candidates debating tonight, the first major debate among the Republican candidates. Lots of questions being asked about where Christians should find themselves in this political confusion. And how about the left? How about the right? How about the center? Liberal, conservative, moderate? Where should Christians be on this spectrum? Let's have an intelligent Christian discussion about these matters. And we're going to have as our special guest today, Dr. Richard Land, author of the new book, The Divided States of America, with a question mark. It's a fascinating book. I was very pleased to endorse it. And we're going to have a good conversation with Dr. Land, my Salem colleague, and with you. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news, at my website I posted overnight an article entitled Of Babies and Believers. Philip Longman of the New America Foundation was interviewed by Bradford Wilcox of the University of Virginia in the current issue of Books and Culture that's published by Christianity Today. I've mentioned Longman before because he's the author of The Empty Cradle, A Look at the Long-Term Impact of Falling Fertility Rates Worldwide. Several fascinating facts, by the way, came out in this interview, and this is an interview between two really smart people, both of whom I respect greatly, Philip Longman and Brad Wilcox. Longman just revealed a couple things. I had not thought of this before. He mentions that there are fewer children in the world today, aged 5 and younger, than in 1990. In other words, if you go back 17 years, people talk about a population explosion. It's a population explosion mostly of people now living longer, not of more children. And I think that fact alone just really revolutionizes the way we look at that whole equation. I'm going to repeat that fact again so it can sink in. If you take all the children of the world, those children age 5 and younger, there are fewer of them now than 17 years ago. That is a very interesting fact in itself. He also mentions that the air quality. You know, people talk about pollution, talk about population as if more people means more pollution. And he points out that America, just as one country, our air quality is now almost immeasurably higher, better than it was, say, back in the 1940s. But at the same time, the population of this country is increased by millions and millions of people over that same period. Now, other things going on in this article I thought were very interesting had to do with the tie between worldview and procreation. We've come back to that issue time and time again. There are people who believe in having babies, and there are increasingly people who do not believe in having them, and the worldview shows through. Here is a quotation from Philip Longman in this interview at Books and Culture. He says this: "The high incidence of childless and single-child families in the West has one big implication many overlook. It means a very large proportion of the children that are being born are being produced by a small subset of the current population. And who are the people who are still having large families today? The stereotypical answer is poor people or dumb people or members of minority groups. But birth rates among American racial and ethnic minority groups are plummeting. The more accurate answer is deeply religious people. To be sure, religious fundamentalists of all varieties are themselves having fewer children than in the past. But whether they be Mormons, Orthodox Jews, or Islamic or Christian fundamentalists, devout members of these Abrahamic religions have on average far larger families than do the secular elements within their own society. In Europe, for example, the fertility differential between believers and non-believers has recently been estimated at 15% to 20%. Though children born into religious families often do not become religious themselves, many do, especially if they themselves go on to have children. Meanwhile, of course, the childless stand no chance of passing along their values to their progeny. The faithful thus begin to inherit society by default. The West's total population may fall or stagnate, perhaps for quite a while. But those who remain will be disproportionately committed to God and family, whether they be Christians, Muslims, Jews, or members of new pronatal, that is, pro-birth, faiths," end quote. It's a long quotation from Philip Longman in this interview, But as I posted it at my website and wrote my own article about it last night, I got some interesting feedback from very intelligent readers. And I want to tell you, just as a matter of fact, I love to hear from you. And these readers who wrote back were picking up the line that I quoted. I said, it goes without saying that this is true. And here's the line from Longman's interview. Meanwhile, of course, the childless stand no chance of passing along their values to their progeny, that is, to their children. Because they have no children, they can't pass their values on to their children. That would seem to be obvious. But I had several very smart and sharp readers who wrote back and said, that's why, if they are educators, they want your children. They want our children. And that reminded me of the article that I cited on this program sometime back from a newspaper in Seattle, where a university professor said just that. He said, we will let the other people breed, and we'll let them invest in their children and nourish them and clothe them and feed them and take them to soccer games until they're 17 or 18. Then they bring them to us, and they are in our hands, and we will shape their minds. It's good to know what folks have as ambitions for our own children. And frankly, I thought it was a very cogent and insightful point made by some very bright readers of my weblog and listeners to this program. You'll find the article published at albertmuller.com. You can follow the links there directly to Books and Culture and read the article for yourself. Speaking of reading for yourself, I would invite you to go to the Washington Post Newsweek project known as On Faith. The question this week has to do with evangelicals and Mormons. And in particular, the question is about Mormonism in particular. It says, is Mormonism an American faith that's moved now into the mainstream? In other words, after 175 years of existence, is Mormonism entering the mainstream of American religious life, or are people still suspicious of it? I wrote a response that I think you'll find interesting. You can find it by linking off of my page at albertmuller.com or going to either the Washington Post or Newsweek, where you'll find the On Faith section there on their websites as well. Tomorrow I'm going to talk on this program about what I had to say and why I felt that it was important to make these points. But you may want to read the article and just go ahead and see for yourself. Meanwhile, some other issues in the news. Climate change is very much a part of the conversation in this country. All this talk about global warming and the rest, Christians, along with others, concerned with how we ought to think about these questions. It's interesting that Times Online, that's the Times of London, is running an article from Sunday's edition that is saying that scientists from NASA now are warning that Mars, that is the planet Mars, has warmed about half a degree centigrade since the mid-1970s. Interestingly, that is parallel to the increased temperature on Earth. Raises a fascinating question. If the temperature on Mars is going up over the same period as is the temperature on Earth, maybe it doesn't have a whole lot to do with what people on Earth are doing. Now, that's not an open and shut case. As a matter of fact, some scientists are arguing that the mechanism at work on Mars is different than that on Earth. One of the researchers, Lori Fitton, believes variations in radiation and temperature across the surface of the red planet are generating strong winds. But one of the interesting questions that arises from this is whether the sun itself or changes in the solar system are responsible for raising the temperature not only on Earth, but also on Mars. Lots going on this week in terms of American denominational life. One of the things to watch is the likely arrival of the Archbishop of Nigeria, Archbishop Peter Akinola, to ordain a man for the Anglican Communion, but not for the Episcopal Church USA. Now the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, has written an open letter calling upon Archbishop Akinola not to come to the United States and perform this ordination or consecration, but rather to stay out. If he does come as is expected, it will be an indication that Archbishop Akinola, who heads the largest single province of the Anglican Communion, will be indeed saying that he no longer recognizes the Episcopal Church USA as a church with whom he and his fellow African Anglicans are in communion. That is a big, big move. Meanwhile, on the Presbyterian front, a group of Presbyterian churches known as the New Wineskins Association has voted to initiate an identification with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. That's the EPC. So this is a group of more conservative churches in the Presbyterian Church USA who finally given up on that denomination. And they are now, and rather suddenly, by the way, making the decision to align themselves with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. Some out there are going to say, well, why not the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA? It appears that the issue is the ordination of women. The Evangelical Presbyterian Church has the position that, quote, people of good conscience can look at the scriptures and come to different conclusions on women in the elected offices of the church, end quote. Nevertheless, in the entire EPC, there are only two women pastors, one of them retiring. Interesting things to watch. Changes on the denominational landscape. Of course, we're also looking at changes on the political landscape as well. That's what we're going to talk about when we come back. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Lots of people have been talking over the last 8 to 10 years about America divided between the blue states and the red states, the Democratic states and the conservative states, the more liberal and the more conservative states. You start looking at all this and you realize there is undeniably a major cultural cleavage in this country. But when you look at the political, social, theological, demographic dynamics, you realize there's a lot more going on there as well. One of the best guides to understand what's going on in America today and how Christians should think about it is Dr. Richard Land. He is president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, host of Richard Land Live right here on the Salem Network. He's also the author of this book, The Divided States of America. It's getting a lot of attention these days, and deservedly so. Dr. Land's on the phone with me now from Washington, D.C. Richard, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mohler. It's good to be with you.
Listen. Your book has to be one of the most interesting things to emerge from a Southern Baptist context in a long time. I mean, I can't imagine a Southern Baptist author, head of our Religious Liberty Commission, that is the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, who is going to have blurbs for his book and a foreword by people like Madeleine Albright and Senator Joseph Lieberman. And Richard, people must be worried about you.
Well, I can even top that one, Al. Last Tuesday, my secretary came into my office. And she had two snail mails, two letters, one in her left hand and one in her right hand. And she said, Dr. Lynn, I've got to give these to you. I got to deliver these to you personally. In her right hand was a letter from the president, said, thank you for your book. I'm enjoying it. And in her left hand was a letter from Senator Ted Kennedy with a handwritten note saying, I'm really enjoying your book. Now, that one worried me a little.
Well, you must be worried about yourself now.
Well, as you've heard me say, my book is an equal opportunity offender.
Well, it's very interesting, and you write this out of your own experience and reflection, and involved in the theological process, involved in the political process, involved as a leader in the Southern Baptist Convention. The title of your book asks a question, and I find that interesting. Anytime a book title is a question rather than a statement, obviously, you're trying to make a point here. The title of the book is The Divided States of America, question mark. Why would you question that?
Well, because I think we do have significant differences and divisions in our country. Obviously, there is a cultural struggle going on. But I don't think that we're as deeply divided as we are led to believe by the media circus that bombards us every day. And I think that too often they get people on the air who have the most narrow viewpoints, and they attack each other. And then the media thinks that's balanced entertainment or balanced journalism, and it's not. And so I think that, you know, I just decided I was going to go over the heads of the talking show, the talk shows and the pre-screeners on those talk shows, and I was going to try to have a conversation with the American people about what I think the conservatives are getting wrong, what I think the liberals are getting wrong, the role that God and religion and faith have played in our past, the role that God and religion and faith play in the present day, and what it should play in the future. And as Senator Lieberman says in the foreword to my book, in a country as religious as this one is, to demand that people separate their deeply held religious convictions from their positions on public policy issues facing our country is both an unnatural and an unnecessary act.
Well, that is eloquent, and that's one of the reasons why I think Senator Lieberman strikes a chord even among those who are not of his party and, frankly, would not share much of his governing philosophy. They do understand this is a man who believes that his own worldview, in his case, the worldview of Judaism, has to inform his political life as well. Richard, in your book on page 177, I'm just going to read you a quotation and ask you to speak about what you're saying here, because I think these are two just really excellent clarifying paragraphs. Mm-hmm. You say, it is not imposing your religious beliefs on others to say, as an American citizen who also happens to be president or a U.S. senator, that you believe abortion on demand is wrong. It is not imposing your religious beliefs to explain that you must believe the wholesale killing of unborn American babies needs to stop. It is not imposing your religious beliefs on others to call for laws protecting embryonic human beings against being killed in experimental research designed, hopefully, to benefit others in the future. It is not imposing your religious beliefs on others to call for laws that restrict the times and the circumstances under which a mother can decide on her own to take the life of another human being, her child. Now, Richard, I agree with you wholeheartedly. But you're making quite a quantum argument there, saying it's not imposing your religious beliefs, because there are many people who say that's exactly what you're doing.
Well, you know, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan used to say, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And the facts are that if imposing your religious beliefs would be having the government demand that every student take religious instruction, either in the Catholic faith or the Protestant faith or the Jewish faith, or to demand that every student say Hail Mary, Mother of Grace, before every school day, or to say Our Father who art in heaven. For a person to have their beliefs about the issue of abortion, their moral beliefs, informed by their moral, by their religiously informed moral values, is their right. It's a protected right under the First Amendment of the Constitution, and they are simply sharing their views based upon their understanding of what is true and what is not true and what is right and what is not right. And it's exactly what the abolitionists did. It's exactly what Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement did. They made moral arguments based upon their understanding of the truth, and for most of them, it was based upon their religiously informed understanding of the truth.
Now, Richard, wouldn't you take that further as well? I mean, for instance, I was just handed an article from Great Britain indicating that the Medical Ethics Board there is saying that Christian physicians who have scruples about abortion or anything like that should explain their religious worldview to patients as a matter of kind of like a free disclosure so that the patients can know this. I noticed that they don't require atheistic physicians to explain why their worldview should also be taken into consideration for medical practice.
Well, that's right, and I think that if they're going to do one, they ought to do the other. The biggest imposition in censorship in America over the last 40 years has been those who are seeking to censor religious beliefs from the public square. As I use an athletic analogy in the book, that the liberals and the secularists are trying to fix the game by disqualifying people who come with religiously informed values from even putting on a uniform and getting on the field.
All right. I think that analogy works. I think it also helps people to understand. And folks, we want you to join this conversation. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. When we come back out of this break, we want to turn to your calls, and I'm going to turn to Dr. Richard Land, author of the book, The Divided States of America, and ask him this question. Is it a theocracy he wants? Out there, there are all these critics on the left, the Chris Hodges and the folks out there who've been writing these books, suggesting that what conservative Christians really want is a theocracy. They've even coined a new word, the Christocrats, they're using to suggest that conservative Christians really need to stay out of the political process because, after all, we're going to contaminate it with our own understanding of Christianity. We'll be back to talk about that with Dr. Richard Land and with you. Call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK, coast to coast. This is the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. If you're a publisher trying to make the bestseller lists and the book tables in the airports, what you need to aim for these days, evidently, are books by militant atheists or books attacking conservative Christians by calling them theocrats. The books are lining up like the landing approach at O'Hare Airport. You can just see them all coming in. Chris Hedges, for instance, a book that I was asked about yesterday, in which he suggests that conservative Christians are trying to create a theocracy here in America. Real scare language there. So let's just hit it head on. My guest today is Richard Land, who is president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention and author of the new book, The Divided States of America. Dr. Land, are you a theocrat?
Nope, I'm not. And you're right. The liberals are using theocracy and theocrat as a scare tactic, as a boogeyman, to try to frighten people. Kevin Phillips is delusional in his book, American Theocracy. I point this out in my book. He says that the Southern Baptist Convention has been taken over by theocrats. Well, I am an elected official in the Southern Baptist Convention. I know thousands of Southern Baptists. I know a half dozen who may be Dominionists and theocrats, and everybody I know in the Southern Baptist Convention thinks they're kooks.
No one, and I say as someone else who's an elected leader in the SBC, no one anywhere close to leadership in the Southern Baptist Convention holds such a position.
That's right. And if they did, they wouldn't hold the position for more than about a week.
Well, I tell you what,
let's
define some terms here. And you mentioned Dominionist, and I would throw in theonomy in this. Let's talk about this for a minute, because the left thinks we're scared to even acknowledge it. So let's just go at it for a moment. Mm-hmm. I get this call every once in a while, especially on Ask Anything Wednesday. You know, who are the Reconstructionists?
Well, they're mainly the followers of Russus Rushdoony, and they want to try to reconstruct a biblical country with Christians being the ones in control. Now, anybody who is a Baptist, by definition, rejects theocracy, rejects Christian Reconstructionism, because Baptists believe, as Roger Williams said in the 17th century, there needs to be a wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the state to protect the garden of the church from the state. And as you will remember, when I gave my convention sermon in Dallas, I said that the last thing we ever want is government-sponsored religion. It's like being hugged by a python. It squeezes all the life out of you, and you fall over dead, and the empty cathedrals of Europe are the classic illustration of this.
Well, let's go ahead and draw some theological lines here. I appreciate the fact that you said that your opposition to the idea of Reconstructionism or theonomy or Dominionism is rooted in your own Baptist identity. As another Baptist, I would agree with that. I want to connect a couple of dots here. That kind of Reconstructionist agenda only works if you think that the society we are to emulate is Israel in the Old Testament.
That's right.
Second point, it only really works if you're a paedo-Baptist. In other words, if you're baptizing babies. Because that way you claim that they are all then citizens of this Dominionist kingdom. Now, as Baptists, we believe in neither of those things.
That's exactly right. We believe in the inspiration of the whole Bible, but we believe that Jesus brought a new covenant, a new testament in his blood, and that the manual for faith and practice for Christians and Christian churches in the new covenant is the New Testament. And we do not believe that America is Israel. We don't believe America is a chosen nation. We don't believe in any in taking our governing model or our economic model from the Old Testament, and we believe that in the New Testament that the people of God are the visible churches of gathered saints who have made a profession of faith in Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, and have signified that by their willingness to follow Him in believers' baptism.
Well, when you start looking at how theology and all these other questions come together, you realize that, again, worldview matters. Worldview just means everything, because we eventually, in terms not only of how we vote, but how we buy and how we operate in every sphere of life, live out our worldview. And what is clear is that we do believe as Christians, and we should speak here for all Christians, to say that we believe that our allegiance to God should come primary and first, but that also includes a responsibility to our fellow man, and that means a responsibility to our fellow citizens. And even as we are citizens of a heavenly kingdom, we as Christians have responsibilities in this kingdom as well. My guest today is Dr. Richard Land. We're going to be back to talk about the 2008 presidential election in particular. Dr. Land gave a fascinating interview to the Wall Street Journal just in the last several days. I'm going to come back on some of those questions, and we're going to talk about how we as Christians should think intelligently about framing our vote, not only for this election, but frankly for any election. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. I do commend Dr. Land's book to you. It's entitled The Divided States of America, at the end of that, because what Dr. Land comes back to argue is that even though there are serious divisions on issues, we are still a country. He still affirms the democratic process. And, you know, when you start looking at this book, you realize that this is not a recent phenomenon. In other words, the cultural and moral and political debates we've been really focusing on in recent years aren't entirely new. Dr. Lane, where do you find the roots of our current, say, cultural conflict in America today?
Well, I think it goes back to a basic fault line that runs through American culture. And it runs not between institutions. It runs through them. It runs through families. It runs through communities. And on one side of that fault line are people who still believe in traditional values. They believe that some things are always right, that some things are always wrong. And then on the other side of that divide are people who are postmodernists. And they believe in relativism. They believe that everything is relative. They believe that nothing is always right. Nothing is always wrong. It depends on the circumstances. And it's very difficult for those people to have a conversation with each other because they can't even agree upon common definitions of words.
Well, they can't even agree upon what a text means. For instance, let's just go back to the confirmation hearings for Chief Justice John Roberts. I'm sure, Richard, you'll remember when Ted Kennedy went to the floor of the Senate and argued against this nomination, saying that he was worried that the now Chief Justice Roberts did not have the right interpretation of the text, which he said means there's the ever-unfolding story of inexorable liberty.
Yeah. Yeah, and this goes back to the wonderful new discovery of the right to privacy, which is a penumbra around the Constitution. It's a mirage. And so you're right. I mean, it's either the Constitution means what it means. My favorite in that whole thing was when Schumer was trying to give Roberts a hard time, and he said, "I just want to know, are you going to be for the little guy?" And Roberts said, "Senator, my job is to defend and to interpret the Constitution. If the Constitution says the little guy should win, the little guy is going to win. If the Constitution says the big guy should win, the big guy is going to win. I'm an umpire, and my job is to call balls and strikes the way they are."
That is refreshing just in and of itself. It's one of the reasons why those confirmation hearings were educational for the American people. I want to ask you the question we brushed by on the lead-in here, and that is this. Looking at the 2008 presidential race, as the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, as one who's been highly involved in these issues, not just recently, but for decades now, are you surprised where we find ourselves in 2008?
Mildly, although after being involved in the process for over two decades, I'm seldom surprised anymore. I mean, I'm surprised if I'm not surprised, because things are very unpredictable. We're in a state of flux. This is an election unlike any election since 1928. It's the first time since 1928 we haven't had a president or a sitting vice president who was capable of running or wanted to run for re-election or for election. That's why we have, at current count, 10 candidates in the Republican field, and it may expand before it contracts. I do think it's interesting that 57% of the people who are likely to vote in Republican primaries say that they are dissatisfied with the current choices. And almost 40% of the people who vote in Democrat primaries are dissatisfied with the choices. And 53% of people who identify themselves as Republicans and 49% of people who identify themselves as Democrats say they would like to see a new face. Now, that's bad news for Mrs. Clinton, because you do realize that when George W. Bush leaves office in 2009, it will have been 28 years since someone not named Bush or Clinton was vice president or president.
That has to be unprecedented in American history, except, you know, going back to the era of the Adams family. But frankly, with the 28 years, you're even past the Adams record.
Oh, you are, because the Adamses only had between them two terms. John Adams had one term and John Quincy Adams had one term. And, you know, since 1981, when George Bush 41 became vice president, we've either had a Bush or a Clinton as president or vice president. And if Mrs. Clinton were to win, it would be at least 32 years.
Now, before we have presidential historians call us, we will stipulate that John Adams was vice president for the two Washington terms. So we'll add 8 years to that.
Yes,
all
we had 12 years of Adamses, and then we had a break until John Quincy was elected.
So about 16 years total. That's a fascinating fact when you just think about the difference between the colonial era, the revolutionary era, when you had so few people really in the elite of leadership versus America
today. It's almost like alternating dynasties.
Yeah.
Clintons and Bushes. Bushes and Clintons.
Well, let me tell you, Richard, I want to go to the interview you did with Naomi Schaefer Riley at the Wall Street Journal over the weekend last weekend. And she asked you about several of the candidates. I'm not going to ask you to do the whole breakdown here. But I do want to get to one core issue, because I was asked by a reporter yesterday about this same issue before I saw what you said. And we, frankly, we said just about the same thing. And that has to do with the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. You know, you were asked about it. And I'm going to quote your statement here, because it's I think, very, very interesting. You said, "I'm not a big enough hypocrite to have made character an issue with Bill Clinton and turn around and vote for men who broke their oaths to their wives," end quote. Now, the reality is that covers a lot of candidates on the Republican side.
Well, it covers some. I mean, you know, we don't know that, well, you know, we know that John McCain has acknowledged that he was unfaithful and has said that he's responsible for the breakup of his first marriage. And he has been married and, by all outward appearances and accounts, happily married for more than 20 years. And he only has one former wife. In the case of Rudy Giuliani and in the case of Newt Gingrich, they both have had two marriages apiece that ended in divorce as a result of adultery on their part. And they're in their third marriages. And I just said, you know, I think three spouses is one too many for most evangelical voters. It certainly is for me.
It's a fascinating time to think about how American evangelicals are going to have to grow up a bit in the 2008 election and think really carefully about what political engagement means for us. We will not necessarily be able to dictate the nominee or choose the kind of profile we might want in the best of all possible worlds. But in the real world of politics, we're going to make some serious choices. One of the good guides to how evangelicals should think about these things is Dr. Richard Land's book, The Divided States of America, belongs in your home and your library. Hope you'll get it. Dr. Land, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Dr. Mulder.
Back with some final thoughts in just a second. The Albert Mulder Program. Well, history does have a way of coming back on you, doesn't it? I'm watching right now televised images of Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain landing in Williamsburg, Virginia, being pulled in kind of a Cinderella princess-like parade of formal coaches, what they call the Coach and Six. And it is very, very interesting. A lot of irony there, isn't it, that the current monarch of the former country of which we were a part is now at Colonial Williamsburg. And just remember what happened there. I mean, right down the street from where the Queen is right now is the College of William and Mary, named for some of her predecessors there in the British monarchy. And she'll be visiting Jamestown, of course, celebrating the 400th anniversary of the whole idea of America as not only a part of Great Britain, but also as a beachhead for a new civilization. A very, very interesting part of the story. We were talking about the meaning of the Queen's visit, and why is it that Americans are so interested? I mean, after all, when Queen Elizabeth, her mother, and the reigning monarch then, King George VI, came to the United States during World War II, there was actually a great deal of concern about having the British monarch here. But now most Americans are quite at peace with the British monarch, and especially with Queen Elizabeth II. And I explained it this way, speaking earlier. I said it's kind of like having your grandmother come to visit, complete with a purse on her elbow and all the rest. And it is something. It is to me, just given an historical sense of sensibility, it is very interesting to see the sight right now of Queen Elizabeth II being drawn by coach through Colonial Williamsburg in the United States. I want you to imagine something with me. Imagine, just for a moment, that you were one of those settlers in the colonial era there in Virginia. Just imagine that you could foresee a time more than two centuries in the future when America would be the most powerful nation on earth, when America would be a transcontinental power, when America would be described as the world's only superpower, when America will have celebrated over 200 years of independence from the only country you have ever known, that is Britain. And just imagine that in May of 2007, a time you could hardly imagine in the future, a British monarch generations removed from King George III would come and would visit Colonial Williamsburg, which is now, of all things, a tourist attraction. Educational, yes, but a tourist attraction. And now along comes the British monarch as one more tourist. A better ride than most Americans would have through Colonial Williamsburg, but perhaps far more meaningful as well. Folks, thanks for joining us today for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We'll be back tomorrow for the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.